The first thing that struck me about my wife's family home in the Philippines was the water system. Her father, my wife's father, had constructed a big tank out of galvanized metal, sheet metal. He made it with a soldering iron that he heated over a fire because there was no electricity there. He connected the tank to the roof, which was made out of corrugated metal, in such a way that the rainwater flowed into a pipe and down into this big tank. And then he connected the tank to a sink in the kitchen, such as it was, and to a spigot in the bathroom, such as it was. And the result was, just from rainwater, he was able to supply most of the water that the household used, not for drinking, but for everything else, for much of the dry season. Now, ever since, I've been wondering why more of us don't do that. We all have roofs. Most of us have land. Why don't we capture this rainwater? It's clean and it's free. And today we're going to talk with somebody who is doing that and helping others to do it too. I'm Jonathan Rowe. The show is America Offline. Amy Schliffman is the engineer. And this afternoon we are going to talk about rainwater, in particular harvesting rainwater. My guest is Brad Lancaster. He's the author of the new book, Rainwater Harvesting for Dry Lands and Beyond. There's now three volumes. The first volume sets out the general principles, and then volume two and volume three give you more detail. Brad is talking with us from his home in Tucson, Arizona, which actually is a part of this story, which we'll get to in a minute. Hello, Brad, you there?
Yeah, I sure am. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much. And first off, I just want to say congratulations. I went into this topic not with trepidation, but with concern that I was going to find myself in a lot of technical detail that I was going to have to wrestle with. But I just found this book to be a pleasure to read. There are wonderful drawings, diagrams, illustrations, stories of people who are doing the things that you talk about. Nice job.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, Brad, I'm thinking, as somebody who has gotten as deeply as you have into harvesting water, it must drive you a little crazy to travel around the country, to travel around your own city and see all of the rainwater that's just running off, going to waste. Is that the case?
Absolutely. And it's maddening to see it happen in both dry seasons and wet seasons. I see it, as you would expect in the wet seasons, as water is pouring down streets, off people's roofs, past their plants, and into the storm drain. And by not capturing that water, individuals are causing flooding for their neighbors, flooding problems for their neighbors downstream. But the less obvious is in the dry seasons. In many of the large cities throughout the U.S., you find the waterways flowing with water in the middle of the dry season. And it's not from rain. It's just what they call urban nuisance runoff or urban drool of people excessively watering their landscapes, and then that water flowing down the street into the storm drain and then the drainages. So we have ample time to harvest water all year round.
Yeah. Have you ever figured out, has anyone ever tried to figure out how much of the nation's water needs could be met by harvesting rainwater better? And I should make a distinction here. We aren't talking about conservation per se about low-flow toilets and shower heads and things like that. Although it's certainly part of the discussion, but we're talking primarily about harvesting the water that literally falls on us for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've looked into that here in Tucson. Tucson, Arizona receives about 12 inches of rain in a typical year of rainfall, and we have about 1 million inhabitants. And we found that more rain falls on the surface area of Tucson than all its citizens consume of municipal water in a typical year of rainfall. To say that another way, the average Tucsonan at home and work or school throughout the day will consume about 165 gallons of water a day, per person per day. But then you look at how much rain falls on the surface area of Tucson, divide that by the population in the days of the year, and you find that there's 235 gallons of rain falling on the surface area of Tucson per person per day in a typical year of rainfall. Now, that's if you were able to capture that water and spread it out over the year. So there's a perceived scarcity, but in reality, there's an abundance. And when I throw out statistics like that, I'm not saying that rainwater should be our primary water source. What I'm saying is, at the very least, rainwater should be a water source. And all too often, it's not looked at that. It's looked upon as something we have to get rid of as quickly as possible. It's looked at as a nuisance or a liability. But we should be looking at it and managing it as an asset and a resource.
Right. The water goes into storm sewers.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's waste. Now, the first question that comes to my mind is, okay, is this, if you were in Tucson or any place else, if you were to make a real effort to harvest more of that rainwater, are you somehow interfering with a natural cycle? In other words, that if I take it from the roof and it goes into my house and I use it to wash my dishes, am I then intercepting it from some other use that is now going to go begging?
No, I think you would actually be making things better rather than worse. Let me first clarify, there's two primary ways that one can harvest rainwater. I just want to make that clear to the listeners, and then I'll answer your question more directly on how you would make things better rather than worse for the local environment and whatnot. So the first way that people think of harvesting water is typically to collect roof runoff through a gutter and then put that water into a tank that they could use that tank water to irrigate gardens or send into the home for flushing toilets or to the sinks for bathing, washing, and so forth. There's another way we can harvest water, and we can actually harvest water with both means at the same time. The second way is a more passive strategy where you're just capturing the water in the soil. And let's say you've got a home landscape. Instead of planting on mounds that would rapidly drain the rainfall away, you plant within or beside rain gardens, which are typically level-bottomed sunken basins that are well-mulched, acting like sponges that rapidly infiltrate the water. The water is then stored in the soil, and you plant pumps in the form of vegetation so the roots can draw up the water and you can access that harvested water in the form of local food production with a fruit tree, windbreaks, wildlife habitat, beauty, air, and water filtration, and so on. So those are the two primary means that one can harvest water.
And so you plant in a hole, not on a mound.
Or you're planting beside one of these holes. But I think a better term than hole would be a basin, because it's not deep and narrow. It's actually wide and shallow.
Okay. Quick question here on that. A lot of people out here, I gather you've been out here, Brad, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you at the Mesa Refuge?
Uh, I Yes, I was out there. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you know the climate that we have, and you may have noticed that a lot of people who have gardens have raised garden beds with wire mesh at the bottom to keep the gophers out. Now,
yeah.
Is this a violation of what you're talking about?
No, because the primary planting associations that you use this water harvesting with are perennial plantings. And with your annuals, if you are planting an annual garden of vegetables and whatnot, say for the winter months when you guys get a lot more rain, then a raised bed makes sense. But in the summer months when you have very little rain, you can have a sunken bed or what's called a raised sunken bed, where you have a raised bed with a perimeter berm around it. So that berm holds all rainfall, but doesn't allow your seedlings to be drenched with excessive runoff from another surface. But when you're planting in association with these rain gardens, that's typically going to be your fruit trees, or it could be native trees like your native oaks, which is another great food producer. And there are many examples of this being done in your area. At the Northern Permaculture Institute and the Regenerative Design Institute in Bolinas, they've got great examples of contour swales in their vegetable garden and their fruit tree orchards. And at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental is another great example of these strategies being put to use.
The show is America Offline. I'm Jonathan Rowe. Amy Schliffman is the engineer. And my guest this afternoon is Brad Lancaster. Brad is the author of the three-volume series called Rainwater Harvesting for Dry Lands and Beyond. It, as I said at the top of the show, it sounds kind of technical, but actually it's a lot of fun, great illustrations, and you read this book, and it makes you want to get out in your backyard and create a berm or something, to put a pipe on your roof to capture some of that rainwater. Now, as I was reading Rainwater Harvesting, Brad, there was a big question that just kept knocking on my mind, It basically boils down to, have we always been so stupid? And by we, I'm talking about the European settlers who came to what's now called America. We can talk about the natives after that. But was there a time, either in the Southwest or any place else, where people were more conscious of rainwater and husbanding it, or have we just always sort of been profligate and stupid in regards to rainwater?
No, actually, every culture has every culture that has lived in an area with a dry season has a history and tradition of rainwater harvesting. We started to forget these traditions when we had the inventions of pumps and whatnot, and we started getting pipes for the very convenient delivery of water to a tap. And we lost our connection with where does this water come from? Our association went no further than, well, it comes from the faucet. But how does it get into the pipes that delivers the water to the faucet? And that's now so out of sight, out of mind, that we've lost that connection. But There's great connections in Europe and with many of the folks that immigrated from Europe in capturing water in cisterns. You find this in farms throughout the U.S. Unfortunately, many of these old cisterns are now filled up with rubble or they're in disrepair, although there's now a resurgence bringing them back. And there was also a great tradition of dry farming, which was farming just on natural rainfall. And to ensure a more successful crop, we used to use more organic mulches instead of relying on synthetic fertilizers that do not feed the soil. We were using organic fertilizers, like manure and compost and whatnot, which would feed the soil, make it more absorbent of rainfall, and thus make our crops less susceptible to drought. There was terrace plantings, contour plantings, which means you create these contour berms across the slope, so you've got level planting areas in which you plant, and the water doesn't flow away so quickly. So we did know, and it's coming back. And in some cultures similar to ours, such as Australia, folks never forgot, because anyone you talk to there either grew up on or knows someone who grew up on rainwater. They don't have the fossil water of groundwater resources that we do, so they had to turn to the rainwater. They never lost that tradition. It never left.
And so if we could visit Tucson, if we could go back in time and visit Tucson, where you live, 100, 150 years ago, would we see cisterns by every house?
It depends on where you would go. If you were in the city where there was active well fields, you would probably see houses connected to the wells or getting water from the well. But you would find a number of homes with cisterns. Not necessarily every home. It would depend on the proximity to the well. And what you would certainly find in the Native American community is people actively practicing runoff farming. That was the way they irrigated their crops. There was no other inputs. They would set up fields in the alluvial sands or next to the arroyos or ephemeral drainage ways, and they would divert the heavier flows onto their field, and they farm seasonally with the rain. About 150 years ago, most of the rooftops were earthen in this area, so it wasn't the most practical surface to catch water from. But when the railroad came in, that brought more materials, such as metal roofs and whatnot, and cisterns actually became a little more popular at that point. And then the piped water system really came into play, and it lost its favor.
I should mention a footnote here to the story I told at the top of this show about my wife's her family's farm in the Philippines and how her father had built a large tank to capture the water from the roof there. The village was electrified a few years ago. They were able to install, in fact, the first thing that they did when it was electrified was to install a water pump from the well. And the last time we visited, I saw that the tank had been discarded, and now they are pumping all their water. And I felt like I was watching 150 years of American history compressed into 2 years.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, that's a pattern that's happened in many parts of the world. I did a research trip to India in writing my second book, and there in Rajasthan, which is the most populated desert of the world, we saw examples, one after another, of whole communities that where every house was connected to a rainwater tank or a community rainwater tank. And it was an incredible system where whole cities subsisted entirely on harvested rainwater. And sometimes it wasn't a tank beside a roof, but it was a large reservoir that caught water from a large earthen catchment. And these fell into disrepair when the British brought in the pumps and the wells and so on, the deeper wells. But now there's a huge resurgence in India because the pipes are going dry. The wells are going dry because the groundwater has been so overpumped, the pumping exceeding natural recharge, that they found the only way to ward off catastrophe is to again harvest the rain, both within the tank and in earthen catchments to speed up or enhance natural recharge to the well field. So they're doing two things. They're reducing their pumping of the groundwater while simultaneously spongifying or rehydrating the watershed that feeds the well field.
I want to put a sticky on that point and come back to it a little bit later, Brad, because what you just described in India, one could say, well, isn't Arizona facing a somewhat similar prospect? The Colorado River is running dry. There's a river in Tucson, I forget the name of it, that has run dry.
Yeah, Santa Cruz.
Yeah. We'll come back to that in just a second. But I need to ask you first, how did you get into this? Did you grow up in Tucson?
Yeah, I did. And I grew up seeing our water resources in steady decline, seeing the riverways, the waterways dry up, lose more and more of the riparian vegetation. I saw our well levels dropping. They've dropped over 300 feet since the early 1900s and continue to drop at a rate of about 3 to 4 feet per year. Then with the use of Colorado River water, I noticed that our soils started salting up at a much faster rate because Colorado River water is so salty. So my big drive in getting into this was I was frustrated of being part of the problem. I mean, everyone that consumes the water in this way is part of the problem.
How old were you when this began to enter your consciousness and you began to connect it to your own behavior?
Well, in junior high is when I really started to see things going the wrong direction, because places where I would go hiking with my father and the family, I would see them in decline each time we'd go back. And then in high school, that became more obvious. But I didn't make the direct connection until college when my father introduced me to a book on the Colorado River Project, which is the canal that brings Colorado River water pumped up 1,000 feet and 300-mile distance from the river to Tucson and Phoenix. And I really started seeing a lot more of the data and made the connection, oh, I'm part of the problem. I'm a big part of the problem. And that's when I started actively looking for solutions.
What was the first thing? I'm guessing that even as a kid, you started doing things around your house, in the yard. What was the first, or maybe it was when you were out of college, what was the first thing you did to get started?
Well, honestly, just running outside when the rain fell, running in the rain, and just observing and seeing what's going on. You know, where is the water coming from? Where is it going? Where does it pool, stick around, and infiltrate and create life? That's what I wanted to build on. And where did it run away too quickly and cause erosion? That's what needed to be changed. And so basically I was looking to the natural world for the examples to follow. And that was one of the big teachers. So one of the first steps I did was just to create large basins, these level-bottomed mulch basins, or rain garden beside or around some of the trees. And the response was amazing. The trees just shot up with a huge blooming of green, and the fruit production was much better. Because not only were they getting more water, but the salt-free rain was leaching the salts out of the root zone, making for a more fertile soil. And when it rains and we have an electrical storm, atmospheric nitrogen, which plants cannot use, is converted to a form plants can use, and the rain brings it right to the roots of the plant.
So you can do this with an existing tree?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so do you, how do you avoid digging up the roots?
So I don't dig under the drip edge or the canopy of the tree, okay? I go beyond the drip edge or the canopy. And then I start digging down. And I'm not digging deep. I'm just digging shallow. And if I start seeing that I'm hitting a lot of roots, I don't go any deeper. Stop. Maybe move a little further off, further from the tree.
And so by the canopy, you mean you create a, you don't dig underneath the branches.
No, you're kind of making more like a, if you went all around the tree, it would be a donut-shaped basin in that the tree and all the land under its leaves, I wouldn't touch. Okay, and that would become a raised platform of sorts. And then beyond the drip edge, beyond the canopy where I'm in direct sunlight, that's when I'd start digging the base.
Okay, and then do you create a kind of a slope feeding into this basin or just a straight wall?
That depends. So particularly when you're using native vegetation, they'll thrive just on the rainfall. And if you just create this basin that doesn't allow water to run away, you're going to greatly boost the amount of available rainfall because now you get all the rain, not just some of it, because it all sticks around and infiltrates. In an urban environment or beside a home, I might direct the runoff from the roof into these basins. And it could just be a shed roof if it's not next to the main house. Or if it's next to a patio, I would ideally my patio is raised so I can slope or divert the runoff from the patio into the adjoining earthwork, water harvesting earthwork. So I'm always looking for what are my water sources and where do I need that water, and I try and match them up. And the big thing to avoid is draining water from the yard or the landscape into the street or the storm drain. So it's best to have a driveway and sidewalks and patios that slope and drain into the landscape, not off-site.
And I assume it's better to have a driveway and walkways that are porous, gravel, for example, that the water can seep into rather than asphalt or concrete that it can't go down.
Well, actually, that depends. If you're in a very urban environment, then yes, a porous surface would be better because you have very few opportunities to infiltrate that water. But if you're in more of a suburban or rural site where you've got lots of land that's unpaved, if you had a concrete or asphalt driveway or patio, you could easily absorb all that runoff in an adjoining earthwork. So you could use your patio as a water source. So everything is always site specific, depending on the unique conditions of the site. But in very built environments, yeah, you definitely want to avoid the already excessive overpaving of the watershed.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm here to ID the station. This is America Offline. We're talking with Brad Lancaster about harvesting rainwater. We're going to do, we'll be back in just about a minute, so stay tuned. We're back. The show is America Offline. I'm Jonathan Rowe. Amy Clifman is the engineer. And this afternoon, we're talking about one of those things that is so obvious and so simple that most of us have forgotten how to do it and even that we could do it. I'm talking about rainwater harvesting. That's the title of a new series of books by Brad Lancaster, who has studied this topic extensively and consults with people who want to harvest rainwater better. Brad, so we were talking about creating, I forget what you call them around trees.
The rain gardens or the water harvesting.
Right, harvest are around trees. And it made me think about something. This is a little bit off the topic, but I know that when they build roads, they build them at a slight angle so that the water drains off to the sides. And usually they make a ditch over there, and the water just goes down into the ditch. And now I'm thinking, with all the thousands of miles of highways and roads in America, are we missing an opportunity there to create landscapes with that runoff?
Absolutely, yeah. We're missing a huge opportunity. So as you notice, when it rains, the water flows off of our streets, which are typically crowned or raised in the middle and sloping to either side. And the water in the rural areas either flows along a roadside ditch or swale, and then in a more urban environment, the water typically flows along a raised concrete curb until it hits the storm drain. So what we need to do, in my opinion, is to recognize this infrastructure for what it is. And these roadside ditches or swales and the curbsides, they are ephemeral creeks because the water flows along them seasonally just during and just after rainfall. So I think we need to recognize them for what they are, these ephemeral creeks, and we need to plant the vegetation that we would naturally find growing along a regional ephemeral creek. And instead of just sending the water on by, we need to supply the opportunity for the water to infiltrate and then passively and freely irrigate the creekside vegetation. And so some examples of what that could look like. So in our rural areas, all streets could be lined with local trees, native trees, enhancing the wildlife habitat and the local ecosystem. And the urban environment could do the same. And let's say we've got, well, let me give you an example from Tucson. And this gives you an idea of the potential. In Tucson, again, where we only get 12 inches of rain a year, the average residential street, that's not a big street, it's the average residential street, drains over 1 million gallons of rainfall per mile per year. That's just the rain falling on that mile section of neighborhood street. So you then look at how much water the area vegetation needs, and we find that that's enough rainfall, that's enough water to sustain over 400 trees per mile, or one tree every 25 feet on both sides of the street. And these shade trees, which can shade and cool the streets and the neighborhoods in summer and reduce flooding by absorbing all of this runoff, they can be irrigated entirely by the street. So it's street trees irrigated by the street. So we're taking care of our flooding. We take care of our irrigation needs. We clean the air, clean the water, clean the soil. We enhance the local ecosystem, particularly for planting native trees. We can enhance local food production if we're choosing food-producing trees. So it's just, I think we should be doing this along every street. Every street can be a green belt. And we've proven that it works here. We've done it extensively in my neighborhood and other neighborhoods. The city of Tucson now legalized this practice of actually cutting curb to retrofit existing neighborhoods to allow street runoff into street-side water harvesting earthworks planted with trees and so on. And if we wanted, we could even be choosing some climate-appropriate fruit trees and so on. In my climate, olives and pomegranates make a lot of sense. In many parts of California, they would as well, but you could also do peaches, plums, apricots, and so on.
You're making me think of the cities that I've lived in, Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston, San Francisco, places where they periodically go on these tree planting things next to the sidewalk. And now it's a situation where there's a curb and water, when it rains, the water runs down the street 1 or 2 feet from those trees, and yet the water goes down the storm drain,
yeah,
never gets to the trees. The trees are invariably anemic, the new ones that they plant, because they just have a little postage size area in which the rain can fall. There's something missing from that picture, right?
Yeah. Well, and the positive thing about this is there's many examples people can turn to now. Through low-impact development in Australia, they call it water-sensitive urban design. And in the Northwest, in Portland and Seattle, they're really doing great things. So Portland's got a Green Streets program where they narrow streets and put in traffic calming strategies that double as water harvesting strategies to passively irrigate the street trees. Do a similar thing in Seattle with their Street Edge Alternative Project or C Streets Project. And all these and many others I have on the demonstration site section of my website, which is harvestingrainwater.com. So people can go there and see listed by country, state, and city examples of where things are being done in a much better way. So they can take these examples to their local communities and say, look what we could do. And in Seattle, through the Sea Streets program, they narrow existing neighborhood streets, lessening the existing pavement by at least 11%. They then have enough room to make the street slightly meander. It's more curvilinear rather than dead straight. This slows and calms traffic, so it makes it a safer neighborhood. Then it also gives them room to make more street-side water harvesting earthworks or bioswales that are well mulched and planted with native vegetation. And they found that this program has reduced runoff by 98%. So it's an incredible flood control system. And it's been a huge boon for the local salmon population, because those salmon were dying before because of the excessive pollution from people, oil dripping from people's cars and their driveways, dog droppings in their yards and whatnot. All that stuff flowing directly into the local creeks and also at high temperature. So it was sediment contaminant rich water at a high temperature that was killing off the salmon and other fish populations. But after they put in these projects in these neighborhoods, now there was more shade, more bioremediation of vegetation irrigated with that runoff water. The water infiltrated the soil instead of running over the soil. So the soil filtered the water and slowly released it. So instead of having peak flash floods of water when it rained, you greatly reduced flooding. And then the other benefit is in the dry season, the local creeks continued to flow for a much longer period of time than they did before. And that's because instead of the overpaved watershed rapidly shedding the water out in a flash flood event, it was now infiltrating the rain like a sponge and slowly releasing it for a period of weeks or months after the rainy season. So this is how we get perennial water flow. It's by infiltrating the water quickly and then slowly releasing it from the soil. And this way we also lose far less water to evaporation. So there's a great precedent that is being pushed by the city of Seattle. Portland's got its program. And there's many others popping up in other parts of the country and in the world. Like I said, in Australia, look up for water-sensitive urban design.
To what extent is this idea spreading to places that that one doesn't think of as being at the ecological forefront? Phoenix, for example, which was the first place that I encountered asphalt front yards painted green with plastic flowers in the flower boxes. Anything happening there or in cities like it?
Yeah, it is starting. And, for example, in Phoenix, they have a rule that no property is supposed to shed any stormwater runoff off of it. The unfortunate thing is they weren't given a lot of guidance on how to sustainably keep it on site, but that's now starting to happen. So you see more water harvesting earthworks, and where you really see benefit is where they're not just keeping the water on site, but they're directing that water to strategically placed shade trees to shade and cool the home in the summer months but allow the winter heat and light in the winter months. so you get the free cooling in the summer and the free heating in the winter. The city of Tucson has just passed two new ordinances. One says that all commercial development must provide for at least 50% of all water needs of the landscape by harvesting rainwater, and all new homes must be installed with gray water stub outs, so gray water can be conveniently and easily directed from household sinks, washing machines, shower and bathtub to the landscape. And you can use your rainwater harvesting earthworks to not only harvest rain, but also gray water. This works great in seasons in areas with extensive dry seasons. So you're capturing the rain when you have rain, and you capture gray water when there's no rain. And the rainwater leaches the salts out of the root zone of the plant, the salts that are introduced by the gray water, and then the gray water's there when you have no rain.
Are there places where the building codes or the zoning regulations actually prevent people from doing common sense things like creating berms in their yards, like landscaping their yards in a way that isn't just a grass carpet, but that has different kinds of vegetation. Gray water, are there places where it's against the law to install a gray water system?
Yes, there are. That's changing. In fact, in Arizona, gray water harvesting was illegal prior to 2002. Now it's legal. And let me just clarify, gray water is the water, again, from a bathroom sink, shower, bathtub, or washing machine. It is not the water from a toilet, kitchen sink, or dishwasher. Those sources are black water, called that because they have higher concentrations of organic matter, which can be food for bacteria. However, if done properly, I think kitchen sink water can be considered dark gray water, as Art Ludwig advocates in his gray water books. But so prior to 2002, it was illegal to harvest gray water in Arizona. Nonetheless, thousands of people did it anyway, and it's thanks to them that the law changed, because researchers decided to study many of these wildcat systems and see, was there any significant health risk? And they found as long as people were following common sense, such as distributing the gray water to multiple points into well-mulched and vegetated basins, there was no problem. The only time there'd be a problem is if people didn't think, and they would just send all the gray water to, say, an open pit in one part of the yard, creating a cesspool. So the researchers drafted a number of common sense guidelines, 13, based on the research they did of these working systems. And they took that to the local authorities and said, look at all the water we could save if these systems were put in, and why don't we change the law to legalize it? Which happened. So now, in Arizona, you can harvest your gray water with no additional inspection fees or permits. You do need to follow plumbing code in the home, but you already have to do that. There's nothing additional. And as a result, there's many more people doing it. On top of this, New Mexico followed suit, and Arizona now will pay you to do it. Anyone harvesting rainwater and or gray water qualifies for up to a $1,200 state income tax credit per household. So things can change, and in some communities of California, I know they're more restrictive, so I would recommend people look to the Arizona model and point that out to your local authorities, particularly your state authorities. Change the state law following the guidelines of Arizona. And they can get information on the Arizona law, the study that changed the law, and our rebates on the gray water harvesting page of my website, which again is harvestingrainwater.com.
The show's America Offline. I'm Jonathan Rowe. Amy Schliffman is the engineer, and my guest is Brad Lancaster. He's the author of the new 3-volume Rainwater Harvesting for Dry Lands and Beyond. And I think Amy has a question, Brad.
Yep.
Actually, I have a comment. Having built a couple of different homes in West Marin here, I found that the county planning department very uncreative regarding gray water, and I don't know exactly if it's legal here, but I do know that if you were to propose something to them, that you would have to do some extensive engineering and design and costly planning to even think about it. And it sort of follows suit with their archaic thinking regarding incinerator toilets or composting toilets as well.
Yeah, so that's very similar to what the situation was here in Tucson. I'm sorry, not just Tucson, but the state of Arizona. And so what changed that was that state law. And the key thing about it is unlike the current law in California, which basically mandates that you need to follow Appendix G of the gray water of the plumbing code. So you're having to follow a specific recipe. The Arizona law is much different. It says these are the best management practices that can be used, and this is the goal. Okay, so you have more flexibility to achieve that goal. And that's the way I'd recommend California follow suit. And you can get more examples and ideas of gray water harvesting meeting the current law and in California and the Arizona law, both in my books, but also from Art Ludwig's website, oasisdesign.net, and he's got some fantastic gray water books.
Brad, what's involved in refitting an existing home to use the gray water? What do you have to do? Roughly how much is it going to cost? And what are you going to use this gray water for exactly?
Okay, let's start real simple and easy. $15 to get a garden nozzle at a garden center that has a shower-like setting, okay? And put that on the end of a hose, throw the hose over a branch of a tree that you want to irrigate in your yard, and in the summertime, when it's hot and pleasant to use, that's your outdoor shower. Okay? Can't get much simpler than that. And you don't need a permit or anything for that because they won't even know it exists.
What do you hook that up to?
Your outdoor faucet.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay, I see. You just take your shower outside.
Yeah, it's just a seasonal shower. You're not going to want to use that in winter. That's fine. But it'll be very pleasant to use in summer when the shower will cool you off and the plants need the water. So that's the real simple way to start. Okay, so you don't have to deal with the bureaucratic headache. Just be careful what soaps you use. You do not want to use bar soaps. And you don't want to use powdered detergent. They're higher in salt. So you want to use liquid soaps. Dr. Bonner's is great. If you're doing laundry, you want to do Oasis or Biopack are two good ones. And I list a lot more on the Gray Water Harvesting page of my website. But let's say you want to start doing it in the home. Okay, we can go up a little bit in complexity. Start with your washing machine. Your washing machine is already above grade, as is bulk of the drain. And you can, if it's against an exterior wall, you can drill a hole through the wall. You can put in an additional pipe next to the one that's already there that sends the water to the sewer. And this new pipe, you can direct right out into the landscape. Okay? And ideally, you're going to, with a simple plumbing device called a flow splitter or double L, you'll split the flow out to multiple points. And I describe these in my books, and Art describes them in his books, so that you're using gravity to direct the water from the washing machine to the landscape. You maintain a minimum quarter-inch drop for every horizontal foot run of your pipe. And this way you don't have to worry about pumps. You don't put the gray water in a tank, which is the last thing you'd want to do. Harvesting rainwater in a tank is fine, but I never want to store gray water in a tank, which unfortunately is what Appendix G of the Gray Water Code says to do. Because when you store gray water in a tank, all that organic matter like dead skin, soap, and everything is food for bacteria that feed on it, die off, and then you get bad odor. So it's better if this gray water goes directly to a mulched, vegetated, level-bottomed basin where the soil life and the vegetation quickly digests the organic matter and filters the water free, and then you don't have the odor. So that's where I would begin.
So this sounds like just what you just described regarding the clothes washer, assuming it's above grade and assuming it is close to the outside wall, maybe an hour or two of a plumber's time?
Yeah, that's
I'm just
all
guessing.
It would be for the plumber. You're laying the pipe in the landscape. Will take a little bit more time just to make sure you got the slopes right and whatnot. Once you've got it set up, it's extremely simple to use.
Right.
And so the other key thing is you never want to send toxins into the landscape. So if you're going to use chlorinated bleach, that always goes to the sewer pipe, which you should have marked sewer. And then when you use biocompatible soap, stuff that's not toxic, that goes to the landscape. You have that part pipe marked. And so, ideally you should never be using toxins, but if you're addicted to them, you can send them to the sewer and then, I guess, kill off the greater community. But the rest of the time, you can use stuff that's appropriate and that actually will enhance your landscape and the community.
Which raises another question. Most people out here, in fact, all people out here, have septic systems. There is no county sewers. Do septic systems come into this equation?
Well, if you have a gray water system, you're going to extend the life of your septic system because you're going to reduce peak input to the septic system. Another strategy, which is beyond the scope of my books and whatnot, is you can use products called Sludge Hammer and Piranha. These are basically putting a compost sock into your septic tank and an aerator. So instead of an anaerobic system, it becomes aerobic, and it cleans the water enough that you can use that septic water for more irrigation options.
Okay. We have a few more minutes, and I'm just going to put this question out there, and if there's anything you can tell us in a couple minutes, I'd be very interested. You know, I used to work in Manhattan and in one of these tall buildings, and I would look out over the city and realize how much of this city is rooftops, which means there's sunlight hitting the roofs, which means there's rain hitting the roofs. Is what we're talking about this afternoon, does any of it apply to the rainwater that falls on the roofs of all these buildings in a city like Manhattan?
Yeah, absolutely. They could easily be harvesting water in tanks. And then did a research trip to Seoul, Korea, where it's now common practice to have large rainwater tanks in the basements of the multi-story building. They have three tanks, and the way they describe it is it's one for me, it's one for you, and it's one for everybody. So the tank for me, that is the tank that's collecting rainwater that I'm going to be using on a daily basis, either to flush my toilets or send to the washing machines in the building's laundromat or so on. The one for you is the tank that's capturing water to reduce flooding, so you're not flooded out. And then that, again, is used within the building. And the third one, for me and you, that is the tank of water that captures water and always has it stored as a fire protection. And also, if there's an earthquake, it's an on-site water source. So this is becoming common practice. And in a hyper-urban environment, you're going to see less above-ground raised tanks and more below-ground tanks because space is such a premium.
Which might help with cooling, too, in the summertime,
yeah.
I'm imagining. We have to go. Tell us again your website, Brad.
Yes, it's harvestingrainwater.com. And there's an image gallery, video, audio, so there's all kinds of examples you can share with people. And tons of free information.
Brad, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. Okay, Brad Lancaster, author of the three-volume set, which you can buy individually, rainwater harvesting for dry lands and beyond. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I went into this topic thinking it was going to be technical and difficult, but it was really fun, and it just makes you want to get out to your backyard and onto your roof and into your plumbing and do something to conserve water and harvest this rain that is falling on us. It's clean, it's free, it's there. Why not? So thank you, Amy Schliffman, engineer for this show, Rock on Tour. KWMR is community radio. We listeners are the station. It just doesn't exist without us. We have to get out of here. Thank you so much. You are listening to KWMR, broadcasting out of Point Reyes Station, and Bolinas.